From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, life inside the prison at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Defense attorney Clive Stafford Smith has written a book about his experiences. It's called The 8 o'clock Ferry to the Windward Side, Seeking Justice in Guantanamo Bay. Smith says countless innocent men have been held there for years with no meaningful review of the accusations against them. We'll get a different view of the prison from Captain Pat McCarthy, chief counsel for the U.S. government in Guantanamo. He says detainees are treated humanely, given access to lawyers, and allowed to plead their cases for release. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. The U.S. prison at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, has been controversial since it filled with roughly 800 terror suspects and accused Taliban fighters 5 years ago, after the U.S. incursion into Afghanistan. There have been allegations of prisoner abuse, as well as complaints and litigation over detainees' access to lawyers, the courts, and even the information that led to their arrest. Our guest, Clive Stafford Smith, is a defense attorney who represents more than 50 detainees at Guantanamo. He's written a new book called The 8 o'clock Ferry to the Windward Side, Seeking Justice in Guantanamo Bay. Later in the show, we'll speak with Captain Pat McCarthy, the government's chief lawyer in Guantanamo, where the number of detainees is now down to about 330. Clive Stafford Smith is a British-born American citizen who heads an organization called Reprieve, which works on death penalty cases and provides legal assistance to what it calls prisoners denied justice in the name of the war on terror. I spoke to Stafford Smith about his work at Guantanamo and asked him to describe the place.
The whole area, it's a bit bigger than Manhattan, and there's the big bay in the middle. On one side, you've got the airport and the place we stay called the Combined Bachelor's Quarters, a slightly odd name. And you take this ferry across. On the other side, there's the big base. There's all sorts of things like McDonald's. And then there's the camp down the bottom. And it's just a huge, small American town, really.
And how are you treated by the military personnel there? How do they feel about a lawyer coming in to defend these folks?
You know, there are two sides to that. People are very nice and professional, I think, by and large. On the other hand, there's an overriding sense, and one soldier told me this, that they had been told that we, the lawyers, were the enemy of the mission. And that's very much the view. The view is that you should keep pesky people like lawyers and journalists as well out of the whole process, which is very sad. And there is a hostility. I've been threatened with being locked up myself down there, which I don't like at all.
Give us a sense of the procedure for arranging a visit. How much more difficult is it than visiting someone in an American prison? I know you've done a lot of work in prisons in the United States.
It's enormous. You have to go way back and recognize that actually we're not allowed, we weren't told in the beginning who the prisoners were down there. And we asked the military to just tell us because there was a group of lawyers who felt very strongly, and I was among them, that we needed to bring the rule of law to that place. But the military took the position they wouldn't even tell us the prisoners they were holding. So the first challenge we had was to identify the folk there. Then the military said we couldn't represent them without someone's permission. We say, hey, well, how about letting us talk to the prisoners? They say you can't. So I had to travel around the Middle East, getting people to give permission to us, family members. Then, of course, we still sued. It took 2.5 years before the U.S. Supreme Court let us go down there as lawyers. It was an endless, endless process. Now, of course, it's a bit better because the Supreme Court has ordered it, but it's been a monumental battle.
There were about 800 or so prisoners originally. It's down to 330. How many there have actually seen a lawyer now?
There's still over 100 prisoners of the 330 who haven't seen lawyers, and that's been down to the fact that we've had such a hard time getting through to them. Of the other couple of hundred, look, there's a real problem even establishing trust. I'm American. I know it sometimes doesn't sound like it on the radio, but we all have to be American citizens to go there. And you go in and you say, oh, hi, I'm an American lawyer. I'm here to help you. Doesn't necessarily immediately establish trust with some chap who's been abused for 6 years in this American detention center. And there are other things, too, that make it very difficult. The interrogators down there go out of their way to make the prisoners not trust the lawyers. One time I went in to see a guy called Shakarama, and he looks at me and he says, you're Jewish, aren't you? And, honestly, I didn't know my dad was Jewish until I was 37, and I was quite surprised that he knew this. It turns out the interrogators had been telling him about the lawyers being Jewish to try and get him not to work with the lawyers. Next time I went down there, one of my clients said, I've been told by my interrogator you like having sex with men. there's just these absurd things that are done to make it very difficult for us to establish trust with the prisoners.
How do some of the restrictions on your interactions with prisoners and restrictions on the kind of information you may have access to affect your work?
The overarching theme about Guantanamo is one of censorship and secrecy. From the very beginning, the whole place was meant to be secret. That's the whole point of it. So, for example, when I go down and visit my clients, I can take notes. I'm sitting there with them. I can write my notes. But I'm not allowed to take them with me. And so I have to put my notes in an envelope that's sealed and then sent by mail to Washington, to a secret place there, where if I want those notes out publicly, I have to pass them through the censors. So anything I talk to you about today, for example, has to have been through the United States censors.
Let's just talk about who is at Guantanamo. You know, I think a lot of Americans, when after 9/11 and after the attacks in Afghanistan, when you know, had the belief that hundreds of these combatants were taken to Guantanamo, and while there certainly may have been some people who were innocently caught up in them, that it was an extraordinary situation, and they were prepared to tolerate some, you know, some different procedures. As you can best tell, how many of those who were taken to Guantanamo were actually captured on the battlefield?
Well, it's a very, very small number. And I should say this, that when I first went down there, I shared what you said. I thought the vast majority of them were going to have been involved in fighting in Afghanistan. And, you know, my thing was the principle that we should give everyone a fair hearing. But I thought, honestly, that I was going to have a lot of explaining to do for some of these prisoners. But it turns out that there's a very, very small number. And when you learn the facts, it's actually quite logical. What was going on was this. The U.S. was dropping these leaflets all over Pakistan and Afghanistan, offering $5,000 bounties. And $5,000 in that neck of the woods is a lot of money. It would translate in American terms to about $250,000 to what we're used to getting paid. So, you know, think for a minute what you would do if there was someone you didn't like, who was some foreigner, who you were just being asked to say, oh, I saw him in Tora Bora, and you get $250,000. The problem was a vast number of people got turned in with one of those stories that were just false. Well, then we followed up with these so-called enhanced interrogation techniques, which, you know, is really a euphemism for torture, and we start abusing people. And, of course, they'll confess pretty quickly that it was true. Yeah, I was in Tora Bora. But then that gets you a one-way ticket to Guantanamo. Unfortunately, there are no lawyers, there's no courts, there's no way of checking out whether it's true. And we've ended up having just a huge number of people there who had nothing to do with any fighting. And, you know, you see that now. Even amongst the allegations made by the U.S. military, there's a very small proportion who are alleged to have actually been fighting anybody.
You said that a lot of people who really were innocent of any connections to terrorism have been caught up, were caught by forces given to the United States and ended up in Guantanamo Bay. What is the review process for seeing whether the accusations against them are credible? Aren't there regular review tribunals which at least review some of that material and are designed to weed out those who have been mistakenly captured?
Well, unfortunately, those tribunals are not up to much. The prisoners are not allowed lawyers. They're not allowed to know the evidence against them. They're not allowed to know many of the allegations against them. And, you know, we have continually asked just to be given a list of what the allegations are to be able to rebut them. And those allegations change over time so much. Each time, for example, with Sami Alhaj, who's an Al Jazeera journalist I represent down there, they've come up with new allegations. I've proved those allegations are false, and then they come up with something else. The most recent things that they gave to him on September the 11th of this year alleges that his terrorist training, if you'll believe it, involves the following, and I quote, "The detainee was trained in the use of cameras by Al Jazeera," end quote. Now, you know, I stipulate that's true. Of course that's true. He worked for them, but it's not a crime. And yet, this is the allegation of training that's meant to prove he's a terrorist.
You know, one of the difficulties with dealing with the detainees at Guantanamo is that this isn't, you know, an American criminal trial. I mean, and one of the reasons in the American criminal justice system that defendants are entitled to, you know, discovery of information against them and they are protected from, you know, self-incrimination and the government has to prove its case is that the government in a civilian setting has enormous powers, the powers to compel evidence and conduct searches and subpoena bank records and other evidence. And, of course, in this setting, the government may be operating in Afghanistan or Pakistan, doesn't have all those powers. And so one could argue that the procedures ought to be different. And, of course, one model is prisoners captured in war. But given that it's not exactly like an American criminal setting. What kind of procedure should be used?
There are some people in Guantanamo who have apparently done some really bad things. Let's not pretend that everyone down there is whiter than white, Snow White. But these people, for example, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is one example. He boasted on Al Jazeera that he was behind the 9/11, the horrendous crime of 9/11. Now, one can make the argument that he shouldn't get a normal trial, but of course you could try him very easily. All you have to do is play the videotape of him boasting on Al Jazeera to any jury in the world that convict him, and, you know, goodness knows what that vote should happen to him. The problem with what we've been doing is that the government, the Bush administration, has been saying this is a whole different world and we can't follow the rules that have worked quite well for the U.S. for 200 years. And they've ended up abusing Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, torturing him. There's no other word for it. Now, the idea that we can bring him to trial is so much more difficult. We could have brought him to justice very easily before, but now the reason the government doesn't want an open trial for Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is because they don't want this evidence of torture to come out. That's the only reason. There's no other justification for it.
And if I could interrupt, how do we know Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was tortured?
Well, he's tried to say it. There's been various statements, of course, by U.S. officials about how he survived waterboarding for longer than any other person. Well, waterboarding's a form of torture, as Senator John McCain has so eloquently said. But he tried to say it in his little combatant status review tribunal down there in Guantanamo, and the government censored it all. They allowed him to rant on about the terrible things he'd done, which is fine. He's going to nail his own coffin shut. But the government very much doesn't want you to hear about the torture. Now, that's wrong. That's just not what America's all about.
We're speaking with Clive Stafford Smith. He is a defense attorney for several defendants held at the American prison at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Clive Stafford Smith. He is an attorney who has represented dozens of defendants held at the Guantanamo Bay prison in Cuba. He has a new book called The 8 o'clock Ferry to the Windward Side. One of the things you do in this book is you look at the Nuremberg trials after World War II as an example of dealing with war criminals. What lessons do you think are instructive that episode for the current challenges facing
It's fascinating on many levels. I mean, the first thing is, you know, I live here in Britain. I'm half British, half American. And it was really good for me to see that after World War II, the Americans were clearly the good guys. I mean, the U.S. is getting a lot of flack right now. But after World War II, Winston Churchill didn't want to bother with trials. He just wanted to string them all up. Stalin, of course, said we should have trials and then kill them all. He obviously knew the outcome of the trials. And it was the Americans who insisted on fair trials. And the Nuremberg tribunals are really quite fantastic. They gave people very fair processes, and 35% of the people charged ended up being acquitted. And that really set a hallmark. It was what America was about. And I don't see any reason whatsoever that we can't do that again today. I think these arguments that somehow the world is so different today compared to then are very, very dubious. And the Bush administration, I'm afraid, has thrown away the goodwill that we gained after World War II.
Well, one difference I can see is that those trials occurred after, you know, the Axis governments had fallen and the Allies had complete control in Germany and could, you know, talk to whoever they wanted to, get whatever evidence they wanted to. Maybe not so easy for the United States government today to accumulate the evidence against some of these folks in places that they don't have free reign.
People might argue that, but I think it's a dubious position to take, because the difference today also is that we've got television, we've got mass communication. And so, you know, these people like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, Ramzi Benalshi, people like that have been on television. We don't need any more evidence than that. And one thing I did, when all of these people like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed were in secret prisons, was we put together the evidence that could be used to prosecute him that was just in the public domain. And I've got this long memo. It's about 20 pages of stuff that could be proved against him that needs absolutely nothing that's secret. So people elevate all these reasons why we can't be fair, we can't afford to live up to our ideals, but I just don't think they're valid.
What do you hear from your clients at Guantanamo Bay about the treatment they have received from the jailers there?
Well, I mean, it runs a gamut, and it's not only what the U.S. personnel have done, but of course we've rendered people to different places. Let me give you the example of Binyam Mohammed. He's a British resident, and he was seized in Pakistan. He was then rendered by the CIA on a plane. We got the plane logs. We know the people on the plane. And he was rendered to Morocco, where he spent 18 months, and they tortured him. And they took a razor blade to his genitals, for goodness sake. And they also did some other pretty unspeakable things to him. They then rendered him back to Kabul, to a dark prison there. It's called the Dark Prison, and they kept him in this other awful medieval place for another 5 months.
And the government doesn't deny that he was taken to Morocco.
No, they don't, and they can't. And indeed, we know that they've got photographs of some of his injuries. They've never let it out, and I wish they would. They should. But, you know, those are things. When I went to law school in New York many, many years ago, it never occurred to me that one day I would sit across the table with another human being and talk to him about my government, the United States, being responsible for taking razor blades to his genitals and other horrible things like that. I mean, that's one extreme. And this is where the Bush administration has cost you and me an enormous amount of international goodwill by dredging up this medieval notion of torture as some solution to our problems. So there's that. And then as you go down the line, those sorts of things, those really extreme things, of course, don't happen in Guantanamo, and they certainly don't today. But there have been some acts in Guantanamo that have been pretty much beyond the pale, and there are still things going on. And anyone who pretends there isn't, you know, I've seen the results of them. I'll give you one example. It's nothing like the razor blade. But Sami Alhaj, my Al Jazeera guy, is being force-fed. Today, I think, is the 289th or 90th day of his hunger strike. And he's only on a hunger strike for one thing. He says, look, don't trust me. Just give me a fair trial. If you don't believe what I'm saying, give me a fair trial. But if you don't do that, let me go. That's all he's asking. Now, the military doesn't want him on a hunger strike, although that's a sort of peaceful protest. So what they've done is they force feed him twice a day, but they don't do it the way doctors do it. They don't do it in the kindest way possible. Instead, they stick a tube up his nose, 110 centimeters long, and each time they do that, they strap him in this chair, they force feed him, and then they pull it back out of his nose. And I tried that because I wanted to see what my clients were going through, and I can tell you it's excruciating. But General Craddock went in the New York Times and said this was being done intentionally to make it, quote, inconvenient for the prisoners to keep on hunger strike. It's torturous, and it's totally beneath us. We shouldn't be doing that stuff.
You know, you can go to the Defense Department website, and they make the case that enhanced interrogation techniques have led to very valuable information. And they also note, we'll list former prisoners of Guantanamo, which were released and have returned to active, what they say is active hostile actions against the United States and its allies. I mean, what about the case they make that, A, there are really bad guys there, and B, that this aggressive interrogation has yielded very useful information?
Well, let's take the first one first, which is they say there are very bad guys there. I think there are some. I've mentioned one or two. But, you know, what you've got to recognize is that when they say that they've let people free and those people have gone on to fight, they let free a whole bunch of people who really were in the Taliban, who were from Afghanistan. They let go the Taliban minister to Pakistan, for goodness sake, whereas they didn't let free an awful lot of people who were just swept up in this whole process and had nothing to do with anything. And they did that because their intelligence has been so bad.
The United States government established military commissions to conduct trials of some of these detainees. And then the procedure was thrown out by the courts. And then a new military commission statute was enacted by Congress last year. And they're now making preparations to conduct trials of some defendants at Guantanamo. Give us your view of to what extent these represent a thorough and fair review of the facts.
You know, there's no way in which those proceedings are fair. I've taken part in one of the procedures. Again, it was in Binyam Mohammed's case. And the client is not allowed to know all the allegations against him, you know, this secret evidence that we're not allowed to talk about with him. We're not allowed to know some of the evidence against him. And when you talk about prosecuting Binyam Mohammed based on torture evidence that was exacted out of him at the end of a razor blade, you know, that's the wrong century we're in.
And from what you've directly observed, I mean, you've been to Guantanamo, what, 20 times or more?
Roughly, I think 19, yeah.
Is it a better run place than it used to be?
Oh, there's no doubt that it's better in many, many ways than it used to be. And I think that's because there's been public oversight now much more through the lawyers and the media. But there are still huge, huge problems down there. And the biggest one right now is this mistreatment of the prisoners over hunger strike. But on the other hand, you know, there's only one way to solve that, really, and that's to open it up and open it up to be a public prison rather than the secret place. And it's the secrecy, I think, is most difficult, most troubling.
Well, what do you mean when you say, I mean, we can't walk into any prison in the United States. I wouldn't describe them as open places. What do you mean by a secret prison or an open prison?
Well, what I mean is one where there's free access for the prisoners to have access to lawyers if they need it, one where there are judges who are actually meaningfully allowed to review the conditions down there. I don't know what the U.S. military is so afraid of, why they won't let good, upstanding American judges oversee what they're doing. I mean, what have they got to hide? That's the real issue. We should treat it like any other prison.
Well, Clive Stafford Smith, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Well, thank you.
Clive Stafford Smith represents more than 50 detainees at Guantanamo Bay. His new book is The 8 o'clock Ferry to the Windward Side. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from The Dial Press, publisher of The Rabbi's Daughter by Reva Mann, a memoir about a young woman's search to find her place within her traditional community. And from Netflix and Universal Studios Home Entertainment, presenting Evening with Vanessa Redgrave and Natasha Richardson on DVD at Netflix.com. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we speak with Captain Patrick McCarthy, Chief Counsel for the U.S. government in Guantanamo Bay. He says all of the detainees there have been advised to meet with an attorney and that his office has arranged over 1,000 meetings between prisoners and lawyers. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. For a different perspective on the conditions at Guantanamo Bay and the legal status of its detainees, we turn to the U.S. government's chief counsel there. Captain Pat McCarthy is staff judge advocate for the Joint Task Force Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. He's been at Guantanamo since May of 2006. He spoke to us from his office on the base. Well, Captain McCarthy, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's discuss some of the allegations that Clive Stafford Smith makes in his book based on his experiences representing detainees at Guantanamo. One of the things he says in this book is that 5 years after they were brought to Guantanamo, fewer than one half of detainees have actually met a lawyer. Does that sound right to you?
I don't think so. I think that right now we have about 300 or so detainees that are represented by counsel. All of the detainees have been advised of their right to meet with counsel. All of the detainees have been advised of their right under the Detainee Treatment Act to challenge their combatant status review tribunal. This year alone, my office has facilitated nearly 1,100, that's 1,100 lawyer visits. That's lawyers here on the ground. So I understand what Mr. Smith is saying, but I just have to say that it certainly doesn't bear out here with my office and the things that we undertake every single day.
Okay, so everyone has been advised of their right to see a lawyer. I mean, I don't want to split hairs here, but have they been able to get one? I mean, do they have access to them? Have they actually met one?
Absolutely right. Yes, we had put into place an arrangement with the American Bar Association to represent those detainees who had requested to have attorneys assigned to challenge their combatant status review tribunals. We have the detainees talk among themselves. They are aware of their own lawyers. There are multiple mechanisms by which detainees who would like to have a lawyer can get a lawyer.
Okay. One of the things that Clyde Stafford Smith says that it's that there are obstacles to lawyers establishing trust with detainees, and one of them is that it appears that all of the detainees have been told all their lawyers are Jewish, and one of his clients said that he'd been told that his lawyer likes to have sex with men. Have you come across anything like that?
I haven't. In fact, okay. I don't know how to respond to that. That's a kind of a naked allegation with no basis in terms of any kind of documentary evidence or anything. I mean, it's difficult for me to prove a negative.
Sure.
But I can say that we have never seen any evidence of that. We have looked into it because those allegations have been made, and we do look into these sorts of allegations. So it's not as if we haven't spoken to intelligence gathering personnel, the interrogators and so forth. It's not as if we haven't looked at the records. But we have found nothing which would indicate to us that that is the case.
Okay.
So
one of the other things that that Clyde Stafford Smith indicated was a problem was the military censorship. And obviously this is... you know, there are a lot of needs for maintaining the security of sensitive information in an operation like yours. But he says that when he meets with an attorney, with a client at a detainee, he's allowed to take notes, but he's not allowed to then take the notes with him. They're placed in an envelope and then mailed by military personnel to Washington, where he has to get them. Is that right? And what would be the basis for that procedure?
Yeah, Clive Stafford-Smith knows, what we do here is all attorney visits are governed by what's called a protective order. The majority of counsel visit their clients here under a protective order that was put into place by the U.S. District Court for the District of Washington, D.C. That protective order requires that counsel who meet with their detainees treat those documents as classified documents until they can be reviewed to ensure there's no classified information in them if counsel seek to have them released publicly. So if counsel want to take them back to their offices and so forth. When he refers to military censorship, that simply is not accurate. His notes are placed into an envelope and mailed to Washington as any other classified document would be. Military personnel are not allowed to carry classified documents about. So those documents are mailed to Washington, D.C., and they're mailed to an organization called the Privilege Team. The Privilege Team is a team that works for the Court Security Officers, or CSOs, and that Privilege Team, they are the ones who look at any documents. The Privilege Team is bound not to release any attorney-client privileged information to the government. So it's an internal process that facilitates the attorney's ability to come down and speak with their clients. All attorneys have to agree to the protective order before they come down to Guantanamo. So if Mr. Clive Stafford Smith or others have difficulty with the protective order, their opportunity to object to the protective order was present at the time they signed it. They could have litigated it and taken it up through the Supreme Court, as other cases have been done. He chose to to sign it and agree to it, and that's what we follow here.
We're speaking with Captain Pat McCarthy. He is the government's lead counsel at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Well, you know, one of the questions that's raised, I think, in Clive Stafford's book overall is whether a large number of detainees at Guantanamo perhaps shouldn't have been there. I mean, I think it's understood a lot of people would expect that in a chaotic environment such as the U.S. action in Afghanistan, a lot of people were captured, and I think most people would expect that the great majority of those captured were clearly enemy combatants or involved in terrorist activity or something like that. But he seems to suggest that a great many, probably a majority, might even have been mistakenly captured. And one of the ways, of course, that is reviewed by the U.S. military are these combatant status review tribunals, which are, if I understand this correctly, held to determine whether an individual detainee should be kept. Is that right?
Not precisely. We've heard this claim before that, obviously, that we have swept up people on the battlefield and they made their way to Guantanamo. Just to sort of go through the process, the first thing that happens on the battlefield is there's an assessment made as to who the individual is at the time that they're brought into U.S. custody. Thousands of individuals are temporarily detained by the U.S. military in connection with military operations. A fraction of those that are initially detained are actually held for any longer term period. A fraction of those that are held for a longer term period come into sort of a moderate term period of detention, and a fraction of those made their way to Guantanamo. So the fact of the matter is that the Department of Defense has had an ongoing process to validate the identity and the affiliations of individuals who come into our detention. Now, with respect to the combatant status review tribunals,
well, can I just interrupt you on that particular point, Captain? I mean, Clive Stafford Smith's book cites an analysis done by Mark Denbaugh of the Seton Hall Law School, which concluded that 95% of those at Guantanamo were not actually captured by U.S. forces, but were turned over by Pakistanis and Northern Alliance forces in Afghanistan, many of whom were responding to cash bounties that were available to turn over suspicious people. And I guess that surprised me, if it's true. It seemed as if I sort of suspected that most of the folks at Guantanamo had been captured by U.S. forces in Afghanistan. Is it not the case that the great majority were actually turned over to U.S. forces, often by people collecting a bounty?
The Denbaugh study is based upon unclassified information that was released in connection with the CSERTs, or the Combatant Status Review Tribunals, back in 2005. It is flawed. It is based on less than half of the available information. West Point has done a counter study, and the West Point study contradicted a vast majority of the findings of the Denbaugh study. And the West Point study had access to, because it was a government-run study, had access to greater information than the Denbaugh study had. The fact is, yes, there were a proportion of individuals that were captured by Pakistanis. These were individuals who had come out of Tora Bora and had slipped across the Pakistani border and were trying to get out of Pakistan and back to their home countries. There were also a certain number of individuals where there were rewards paid with respect to those that were brought forward by villagers and so forth and so on. It is a relatively small number of people that in cases where rewards were paid. And the fact of the matter is that the majority of individuals who are in Guantanamo were captured in Afghanistan by U.S. or coalition forces. Now, because I do have this opportunity, I would say that the American people, I believe, would expect that the U.S. would not stop at the Afghan-Pakistan border and simply throw up their hands and say, well, they got away. In addition to the individuals who were not captured in Afghanistan, is Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. He wasn't captured in Afghanistan, and numerous others. And the fact is that we did take individuals from various areas in and around Afghanistan. We brought them in, and then we did the same thing as I described previously, where we went through, we validated the identity of the individual, the affiliation of the individual, and that individual's activities. And it's through that validation process that we are comfortable that we, in fact, do have individuals that warrant detention in Guantanamo Bay.
Captain Pat McCarthy is the U.S. government's lead counsel in Guantanamo. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Earlier in the show, we heard from Clive Stafford Smith, a defense attorney for detainees at Guantanamo Bay, who charges in a new book that countless innocent men have been held there for years with no meaningful review of the accusations against them. For a different perspective, we're speaking with Captain Pat McCarthy, the U.S. government's lead counsel in Guantanamo. Well, let's talk a little bit about the process by which their status is reviewed. That's the Combatant Status Review Tribunals. And again, this is not a trial for a crime. This is a review in part to determine whether they, indeed have a status that would require their retention at Guantanamo. Tell us a little bit about what happens there. Do the detainees in these proceedings get to look at, are they informed of evidence against them? Are they represented by anyone?
They're not represented. And to back up, what the Combatant Status Review Tribunals are essentially a process by which the initial battlefield determination of enemy combatancy is confirmed. So it doesn't actually determine that an individual is an enemy combatant. It confirms that the individual is an enemy combatant. So what happens there is the tribunal considers information which the U.S. government holds on a particular individual. The detainee is granted access to unclassified information that may pertain to him. He's also given an unclassified summary of information that that is developed off of classified information. There is an individual called a personal representative that assists the detainee in preparation of his general response to the factual predicate that the U.S. government is using to confirm that the individual is an enemy combatant. What happens is that the CSRT, the tribunal itself, is required to look at all information, both information that would indicate the individual is an enemy combatant, as well as information that would indicate he is not, or would indicate somehow or undermine the case against the detainee. The tribunal takes all of that into account as it makes its determination as to whether the initial finding is correct. So in terms of its confirmation of that earlier battlefield assessment that an individual is an enemy combatant.
And is the detainee allowed to address the tribunal in these proceedings?
The detainee is allowed to address the tribunal, and the detainee is allowed to call witnesses that are reasonably available.
Well, when detainees are eventually tried for crimes, the venue is these military commissions. There was one set of commissions which I guess was struck down by the courts, and then Congress last year authorized a new process for establishing military commissions to try detainees. Is that right, Captain?
That's correct. The Military Commissions Act was struck down by the Supreme Court in the Hamdan case, and Congress passed the new Military Commissions Act in December of 2006.
Okay. What will happen with the rest of the 300 or so detainees at Guantanamo?
Well, the current projections are there will be somewhere in the order of 50 or 60 or so prosecutions for individuals who have committed war crimes. And then whatever occurs out of that, individuals may or may not be sentenced. If they're found guilty, they'll be sentenced to some sentence, and they'll serve their sentences. Others may not be charged. Others are being held as enemy combatants, consistent with the law of war, which permits countries to hold enemy combatants till the end of hostilities. Now, I've got to tell you that I've been asked, well, how long will that be? And my response, not being flippant, is, I don't know, you're asking the wrong guy. We didn't start the war. It was begun on the 11th September, and some would argue well before that, and we are not in a situation where we can control the ending of the war. In fact, I think that the troublesome part is, I think everyone understands that we don't know who is in a position to control the ending of the war, unlike a traditional war where you have a government that surrenders. So for those who are not prosecuted, they will either be transferred back to their home country with some sort of assurance that they will not again present a threat to the United States, or they will be detained in accordance with the law of war.
Do you see the war on terror coming to an end?
I think that everyone has to ask that question. Philadelphia was spared on the 11th September, thank God, from what occurred on that terrible day. And I think what all Americans have to think through is, do we think it can happen again? What's the best way to avoid it from happening again? It's far too comfortable for commentators such as yourself to ask me why it's my problem. It's not my problem. You know, it's America's problem. I was at the Pentagon the day it burned. I was there. And I had friends that died in that facility. And you know, I think those in New York understand it, but their memory's probably fading as well. This is a question for the American people. How are we going to detain guys who we pick up, who we know to be threats? That's a big question. It's a big issue. Should we bring them to the United States? Should we set them free? Should we give them a little stipend and thank them for their job? Maybe they can come back and do a better job next time. I don't know what it is, but this is not a question only for the military. Iraq, that might be a question for the military and for those families that have loved ones overseas. But the war on terror on September the 11th, it became a question for all Americans, and every American's got to ask that question. And they've got to bear the responsibility for the outcome of their answer.
We're speaking with Captain Pat McCarthy. He is the United States government's lead counsel in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Captain Pat McCarthy. He is the United States government's lead counsel in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Well, Captain, I wanted to talk a little bit about interrogation techniques. And Clive Stafford Smith says his clients tell him that they have been beaten at Guantanamo. What kinds of interrogation techniques are permitted there? I mean, is waterboarding, for example, but putting someone underwater, stress positions,
absolutely
that kind
not.
Of thing?
In 2006, in the fall of 2006, the Army Field Manual was amended to very clearly state the interrogation techniques that are authorized around the world. There are misperceptions about what has occurred in Guantanamo. We have had major investigations. We have never had a case where torture has been uncovered here in Guantanamo. Now, with that, I want to say that there were issues of overzealous interrogators in the early part of the mission here, And that is clearly unfortunate. But in today's way of that we do business here, all interrogations are done by what's called direct approach. And direct approach is the interrogator asks the detainee a direct question, and the detainee either responds or doesn't respond. There is no sanction whatsoever for a detainee declining to respond. In order to build rapport with detainees, interrogators will often take in food items. So we have Subway here. Many of the detainees like Subway sandwiches, so the interrogators take in Subway sandwiches. We have a Pizza Hut here. The interrogators take in pizza. And chewing tobacco is a very hot item here among the detainees who speak with their interrogators. Cigarettes and other sorts of what we call incentive items are available to interrogators who speak with detainees. But there, you know, these depictions of ham-fisted attempts to get detainees to speak simply are not a part of any kind of contemporary reality.
You said there were some issues with overzealous interrogations early in the history of Guantanamo, but wasn't in early last year that a report done for the UN Committee Against Torture concluded that the treatment of detainees amounted to torture at Guantanamo?
Well, I don't know. I'm not familiar with the exact findings of that report or the conditions that they looked upon. I don't know what that is. I can tell you what the conditions are here today. Every single detainee has the ability to speak with all detainees around him 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. All detainees have a minimum of 2 hours of recreation each day. That's outside recreation. When they're in recreation, they have the ability to talk to detainees that are in adjacent recreation areas. A large proportion of the detainees live in a communal camp setting, which means that they get to talk to other detainees all day long, and they get to interact face-to-face and have robust social interaction all day with up to 15 or 20 detainees at a time. We serve 3 meals per day with up to 5,000 calories total in the meals. All of the detainees have prayer beads, prayer rugs, Qurans. All the detainees are allowed to pray 5 times a day. All of the detainees are allowed to pray uninterrupted by the guard staff. In fact, we put cones out with a P on the cone to indicate that it's prayer time, so that the guards keep any extraneous noise to an absolute minimum. And we don't do movements of detainees during the prayer period. So I'm not sure what the United Nations found to be torture, but those are the conditions, and if those are the conditions they found to be torture, then I just have to say I'm not sure I agree with their definition of that term. And I think, in fact, that loose definitions of that term undermine the seriousness of that claim. I think it's important to remember that Mr. Smith is an attorney representing his clients, interested in getting his clients out of Guantanamo. So while I'm not saying that all of Mr. Smith's claims should be dismissed, I am saying that these claims should be appropriately viewed, and there should be a balanced approach to the claims that are brought up.
Fair enough. Captain, is there anything else that you'd like to say?
Well, I would like to say, the final thing I'd like to say is that I think that Guantanamo has been painted as a place where individuals are sent, they're held incognito, they lack access to courts, they lack access to right to family members and so forth. The media is held out of Guantanamo, and there generally is this cone is lowered over the facility. And nothing could be further from the truth. The fact is, as I said earlier, we've had almost 1,100 lawyer visits this year. We had about 900 lawyer visits last year, about the same the year before. We've had well over 500 media visits this year. We had about 1,000 last year. We currently have multiple cases at the United States Supreme Court. We have many more cases at the U.S. Circuit Court for the Circuit of Washington, D.C. We have many more than that at the District Court for the District of Washington, D.C. The fact of the matter is, we are trying to hold, on behalf of the American people, individuals who pose a threat to the United States, a serious threat to the United States, and we are trying to do that in a way that is humane and safe for the staff and for the individuals that we hold. I just want to leave you with that and your listeners with that, and I really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today.
Well, Captain, thank you so much for joining us.
You too. Bye-bye.
Captain Pat McCarthy is the U.S. government's lead counsel in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer this week is Roberta Shorrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Joan Tui Westman, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, Sam Brigger, and Jonathan Menhivar. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble and the Barnes & Noble Review, the new online literary magazine with reviews, interviews, and recommendations. From Netflix and MGM Home Video, presenting Mr. Brooks, a psychological thriller starring Kevin Costner, now on DVD at Netflix.com. And from Audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/fresh air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
He's played a serial killer, a baseball player in a slump, a cavalry lieutenant who goes to live among Indians, and a federal agent out to get Al Capone. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with actor Kevin Costner. His latest film, Mr. Brooks, is now out on DVD. Join us for the next Fresh Air.